I am so delighted tonight to be able to welcome Laura Sims, who has recently published a new book, Our Secret Territory, and she is going to be talking about that and the wonderful international work she has been doing, particularly in Haiti. So not to waste any more time, I'm excited to turn it over to you, Laura.
Thank you, Lynn. And I loved hearing everybody's voices, and exciting chaos that ensued. So now I feel like there's somebody there. And I wanted to focus this evening on the less tangible aspects of the storytelling work that I've been doing, and the kind of sort of foundation or view of what has been really sustaining me in terms of doing this healing work. And to give a little background, there are really two main streams of practice, training, and dedication in my life that both are really influencing me for more than 30 years and really have always related to each other, but now really have come together, which is a relief. And the one, of course, is being a storyteller. And I began my quest, my journey of becoming a storyteller in 1999, quite by accident, actually. And from the very beginning, what grabbed me beside my love of stories, which I think we all have, was it something extraordinary, even in the first raw telling that I did quite by accident in Central Park one afternoon, actually it was April 15th, was somehow recognizing that what occurred between myself and the listeners, some state of mind that was exposed, was so powerful and seemed to be really, really important. And it took me, it was first going to be a little detour that I was taking. I dropped out of graduate school maybe for a year or two, but now it's actually 42 years on this detour, to really find out what this reciprocity of this dynamic ritual of engagement really is about. And it led me to what is, I consider, the second stream of training and focus in my life, which is the practice of meditation. And originally I became involved in Tibetan Buddhism because when I was doing this very potent and kind of delicious, almost secretive research in the special library at the Museum of Natural History, I was reading missionary journals and anthropologist reports about shamanism and also traditional mythic ceremonies and rituals and culture. And so I really started meditating because I thought I could learn something about the nature of mind and that I would be my own laboratory, which has continued for over almost 40 years now. So these two streams, and I just wanted to back it up so that there was no hidden agenda, and you'd understand where my work really stems from. So that's been what I've been doing. Those are both, that's been my career, but it's also my constant practice has been the practice of deepening my meditation practice, which has to do with sort of being present. It's not really a religious event, but it has to do with a kind of internal study of the nature of mind itself, which has been so inspiring in terms of learning more about story and how story functions, but also about the whole process of engagement of storytelling between listener and teller. So in the end, I've begun much more systematically to work in difficult situations. And what I really am doing, a good part of that work, is training health workers, educators, therapists, street teachers, at least in Haiti, to really use narrative in three different ways. And one is the immediacy of engaging people in listening to a story so that there's immediate relief. And also through the story, a kind of template of a journey that takes people from one place, overcoming obstacles, through to another. That's just simplifying the whole thing. But the second is really engaging people in telling their own stories and in listening to each other's stories. And those are kind of like two wings of a bird, since listening is such an important component and being heard is such an important component of beginning to heal ourselves or transform fixed stories and reframing how we view our lives and our capacity to listen to others. And the third is really creating transformatory stories that, and I use the structure, the basic structure of fairy tale and folk tale, different structures, to help people to create stories in which they could explore almost on an alchemical level how to move through situations and perceive a difficult situation in a different way, almost finding the medicine in obstruction. So I attempt to train people literally to have access to a kind of role of the storyteller, so that not only are people learning about the text and the sort of outer meaning that the text reveals, but are beginning to understand the energy, the alchemy, the sort of acupuncture points of story and image and journey that really unearths people's inherent empowerment, relaxation, and ability to change. I hope this is making sense. And in Haiti, it's been really poignant and also very, very beautiful. So the way that I've been able to approach the work and be in difficult situations for myself is two-sided. And one is, I mean, the definition of compassion is to feel or experience the suffering of others. And so I've had to make myself a body strong enough to be able, without running away or reinterpreting or trying to fix things, to actually feel, to empathize and feel the suffering of others and to listen deeply to what they're saying and how they're saying it, and to feel into a situation and discern between my own interpretation or assumptions or what I think is healing or good, to discern between my own assumptions and the capacity to discern the unbiased experience of hearing their own storyline, their own experience. And the second part of it, what's really important and what I think allows me to really love the work and not feel defeated, because I know that very often I can't make huge changes in that situation, is that I know that I can celebrate completely that through this whole process of working with these three kinds of narrative, that I am offering people a kind of self-liberation, that regardless of circumstances, they can feel an innate sense of kind of ceaseless inner reservoir of joy, of potential of imagination, of intelligence, and even deep contentment, even when there's tremendous misery around them. And I am emphasizing that this evening because I think that so often what we're trying to do is to unearth content, and that is important, but this is also an additional and important aspect, and that each time we allow people to feel their innate joy, regardless of where they are, that it's like throwing open a window from the inside and letting people access a part of themselves that is untarnished by the conflict, by the disaster, by the abuse, by the self-upset or frustration or rage or whatever they're feeling. There's some place that is not touched by that, that is like an oasis or a deep well of refreshment. And so a lot of my work has to do with how, even in working with telling, getting people to tell their story or telling a story that I know has great psychological depth, part of the treasure, I think, of what the storyteller can do is allow that place to be radiant and responsive and alive. So in a way, it's similar to what Augusto Ball said in terms of theater, that you think of the event of the theater as a rehearsal, not the revolution. But you have to rehearse. You have to know and be able to access this place in oneself to have the distance in your everyday life to not be completely swallowed up by despair. So I wanted to tell three stories. And the first one is about the first day in Haiti that I went into a camp to tell stories in what's called the mother and children's tent. And my first job in Haiti was with International Medical Corps, a wonderful organization that trains doctors and psychiatrists to work in emergencies. And why I love them is because they train Haitian medical workers. So it was my job to train 24 health workers who were creating programs in camps and orphanages. And each one of them would have up to 10 or 15 situations where they worked, and sometimes worked with thousands of mothers and children. So I gave a two-day training to them. And in this training, they listened to traditional stories and personal stories. They discussed it. I got to know them somewhat. They each made, you know, something I've been doing for the last 15 years of working with place as a source of finding a childhood story and then working in pairs, listening and talking and retelling stories. And so each person had constructed through this process a beautiful childhood story that had not only personal meaning but some kinds of transcendent universal meaning as well. And they each worked on one of three of the traditional stories that I told, learning how to tell it, rehearsing it, talking about it, drawing it, practicing with each other, reflecting on their own lives in terms of the story. And then I took them through a day-long series of activities, which I've called Making Monsters or Transformation, in which they created fragments of stories that resulted in their inventing an original fairy tale in which something tremendously out of balance is rebalanced with their choice of a character, usually actually some manifestation of themselves being the hero or heroine who has an object and then helps to win back that object from a monster that they've created. And they make the life history of the monster, even the past of the monster, how the monster became infused with greed or rage or violence, but how that same energy could be used for something positive. So they were armed with all of that, and each camp or orphanage I went to, six of them came with me, and we would spend 2 hours with the mothers and children, and then we would spend time afterwards talking about what happened and what they could do, and then the last day was how each of them would continue this project, which actually they still are. But the first tent that we went to was in Carrefour, and it's a very, very poor part of Port-au-Prince in Haiti, the capital. And it was badly destroyed during the earthquake. And when I climbed up the hill to go to the mother children tent of IMC, the sky was incredibly blue, tropical sky, and sort of the magnificent mountains of the Caribbean. And what I saw at first was it just looked like there was a vast and cloud bank that had landed on the sides of the mountain and in this valley. But when I got closer, I realized it was thousands and thousands and thousands of blue tarps that were tents. And when I got even closer, I could make out how, even though it was only 6 months after the earthquake, they were already covered in dust and quite shabby, with makeshift doors and mud and dirt in between, and no privacy in the bathrooms, and laundry hanging, and just a kind of the whole village of despair of what a camp can be. And I literally was overwhelmed. What did I have to offer at all, given the immensity of what was in front of me? So we went into the tent, and the IMC brings mats, clean mats, and all the toys, which they take out when they leave, so that for the period of time that people come into the tent, usually they're being given medical help or training of how to take care of their children, how to know what to do in terms of cholera, etc. So it is very beautiful preparation of putting the mats down and opening the flaps of the tent and tying them back, and opening the top of the box that has lots of balls and little toys for children in it. So there's a kind of preparation, a ground. And as this was happening, women and children were very slowly coming into the tent, and as soon as the mats were down, they would kind of almost collapse like flowers that had not been watered for a long time. And the women would just lean against the tarp walls. Babies were on their laps, and young children just sort of crawled into the center with the relief of the clean mats and just splayed out as if they were asleep. And I was standing with the IMC staff, the mentors, and my translator, Viveda, and literally thinking, oh, my God, what can I do? I don't speak French very well. I have no Creole. And what am I doing here that can be helpful whatsoever? And at one point, Viveda said to me, well, if any more people are coming, they'll come late. Let's start. So I just plunked myself down and tried to sort of raise my life force to just be really present and banish from my mind my own preoccupation with a sense of worthlessness and helplessness. And as I did this, the children stood up, those that were lying down, and they formed a single line. And I just watched this in kind of amazement. And then one at a time, arms reached out with smiles on their faces, they came toward me, kissed me on both cheeks, gave me a hug, and then would sort of fall back onto the mat. And I said to Viveda, what's happening? And she said to me, oh, they're welcoming you. And I understood that I was in really a safe place. I was in a place where there was great culture, and this was completely beautiful in the midst of this miserable situation. This absolutely beautiful ceremony of their welcoming me occurred, and I felt so joyful, and I just began by thanking everybody and telling them a little bit about myself. And then I started by telling a story, which is actually from Diana Volkstein's book Magic Orange Tree, about a turtle who wants to fly to New York. And I did it with lots of gesture, kind of inventing call and response. And the children were just sort of like popped up out of their inertia and just sort of stared at me, astonished, even though it was being translated. And then, shyly at first, but more and more, they just began to participate with completely illuminated with joy. And I watched the mothers kind of watching from their sort of wall of exhaustion. And then after that, I told this squeaky door, and I'll be glad to post this, actually, because you can. I have little films of this. And the children really then joined in, and mothers began to laugh, you know, delighted that their children were joining in, but also, I think, because it was so reminiscent of something in their own childhoods, because crick-crack storytelling was alive and well not too long ago. And then I introduced a story that I didn't really know well from Diane's book called Tezan, but I loved it, and asked if anybody knew it, and everybody said no. But then from the side of the tent, a woman began singing, and she was singing the song, the refrain of Tezan. And when she started singing, all the other women started singing, so suddenly the tent was just enlivened by women's voices, and I just saw the children turn and look and listen as if the sound of women's voices had just bathed their bodies, everyone. So I began the story, and I said, I don't really know this very well, so if you remember any pieces of it, you can tell it to me. And with Vafeda sort of translating like a kind of a mediator, hunter-gatherer for pieces, people called out sections of the story, sometimes out of sequence, sometimes sections that were very different than I knew, different versions. And a woman even in the middle of that story was reminded of a fairy tale that she hadn't thought of in 20 years. She was wearing a very, very stained red dress, and she told this immensely beautiful fairy tale. And everyone sat up, and at some point I realized that what had occurred was that the women, it was as if the engagement, the awakening of their own imagination and memory, their focusing outward on each other into the story, drawn out of their own preoccupation, energized them. It moisturized everyone as if they were drawing up water into their bodies and were listening.
On the counter, by the
and
door.
when this, I'm just looking to see what time it is.
It's almost 9:30, Laura.
Okay. But when
but you started 5 minutes after nine.
When the thank you. Mm. When the hour and 20 minutes was over, it was time for us to leave because I would spend now an hour sitting outside with the mentors. But one of the mentors said, let me tell my story. And she jumped up and said, creak. And all the women were about to leave, but they didn't. And they said, crack. And she said, no, creak. No, no, encore, again. Until they all called out crack and just burst out laughing. And she told a story, her childhood story, which was an utter story, like the fairy tale, of herself who was a stepdaughter maligned and abused, who was forced in junior high school to wear high heels every single day to school. They were used and they were inappropriate. She hated them and was humiliated. She never said that, but the whole time she spoke, you could feel it. She kept her feet wrapped under the chair she was sitting on, and the women just listened, astounded by this personal revelation of her pain, which they all could relate to. And then at the end of it, she paused, great pause, actually. And then she drew her feet out, and she just held them up in the air, laughing. And she was wearing high heels. And she said, look, she said, now I can't live without high heels. And I love them. And everybody started clapping. Because whether or not it made sense, or like her misery, she had transformed it into victory. And now the IMC staff was really chasing us all out. And right at that moment, one woman said, wait, I have to say something. And she said, our lives are so hard, and we have lost everything. But I want to thank you today, because I remembered that we do have joy. And they left. And what I felt was that was the most important experience that occurred. So I want to tell one other story, and then I'm actually going to just open this up to questions, because that'll be more relevant. And this is a story from India. It's actually a Buddhist story. And it's about a great sage named Chandrakirti in, I think, 9th century. He's a great teacher and a compassionate man. And there was a drought in this part of northern India, which caused immense suffering. And so little food, no water. And he came to a village. He traveled from village to village, attempting to offer whatever help he could. And he stopped in someone's meager house. And whatever they had, they cooked and prepared and offered him of utter generosity. And he was so moved by this. And he looked around their room, and then he saw on the wall a painting of a cow. And he went to the painting, and he milked the cow and fed the whole village. And I feel that when, as storytellers, we unearth this place in ourselves and have faith in that celebration, and can open this place for others, that we offer this inherent well, this resource of contentment and joy, of distance, of space, of the place where really imagination insight arises, like sustenance that supports everything else that we do and is grand protection from falling into misery, and also dwelling in trauma. There is a relief and a kind of spacious distance that's provided that allows one to be in one's circumstances and also to even tell the difficult story without that being the only story that one identifies with. And so often what I did in Haiti was work with having people tell stories, not so much of the day of the earthquake and what happened to them, but of the intense fear they experienced. We would never do that without first allowing them to have this experience of their childhood story and this innate sense of presence and joy as the background, so that they could always go to that and have this resource to draw from, so that they were not at an option, as opposed to being re-traumatized or habitually falling into this state of mind. And it's that energetic aspect of storytelling that I feel is really a strong antidote and a strong healing that we can all really work with in addition to everything else we're doing. So you could demute.
Demute, exactly.
Mute and arise.
Any questions for Laura?
How long did you stay in Haiti, Laura?
I've gone 6 times, and each time was between 6 days and 3 weeks.
Laura, I was hoping you could say more about helping people to tell this first childhood story. And it sounds like you're going for something that will remind them of joy.
The reason why I will tell you about that, and it's something I know a lot of storytellers have done because I've been presenting it for like 15 years. But the reason why I'm presenting this aspect of it first is because in order to elicit from somebody, this is at least the work that I've been doing, a story that is really grounded in an experience, not only that the content is joyful, but the telling allows you to feel the poignancy, sometimes even the depth of sorrow, in a very deep way. So it's not a sort of like, this is really nice, but to actually be penetrated and feel the experience. I do a lot of work with presencing and sort of preparing the ground so that first comes the sensual, visceral experience of being present, and then the engagement. And then I would have people do a whole bunch of movement exercises that are very specific, leading up to their choosing, seemingly randomly, a place, and breaking people into pairs, helping them, you know, to sit in pairs so that they are not only speaking and remembering, because we're going from memory into story, and so what you remember at first is very different very often than what the story will ultimately be. But people choose a place, and I have them describe the place and not talk about what happened or how they felt about it, so that our usual habit is to be very engaged with what happened somewhere, and also our assessment of it. Well, it was really great, I loved that, it was beautiful there, and this is what happened. So it's a process that I take people through of really viscerally experiencing through visualization and kind of increasing memory, even sometimes walking through the place until the place becomes more vivid and internalized without the storyline. And that really allows for somebody to tell the story, not just the litany of events or how they have remembered it always, but to start getting underneath into more sense of what happened there, and also begin to trust that instead of always saying, well, I loved it, yeah, that was really great, that within the description, your partner hears the feeling at a much more subtle and diverse level. So it's allowing for much more visceral, emotional connection and sensory memory, so that it's not sort of intellectual or conceptual. So that's how I started. And then one of the later activities is one thing that you did in that place. And then through another series of activities telling back and forth, a story begins to emerge, and then we really practice discerning between what the litany of events is or what you assumed it was and how to make a story so that you have something that you've lived through now and someone else can live through it. And so there's a lot of almost call and response and deep partner listening. Is that a helpful answer?
Oh, beautiful. Mm-hmm.
And then that place is, because it's a visceral place, it's internalized. And so rather than it being, oh my God, how depressing to remember that place, mm-hmm. it is as if the memory has been there all along, and that place is your home, internal imaginative restoration home. You don't have to frame your story of loss, but actually you have this place almost like a field you can return to inside yourself that is self-nourishing. And very often, if I have a lot of time, I'll ask questions, and there are ways that I create writing activities in it where people might talk about who wasn't in the place, tell the story from the point of view of someone else, let your partner tell you back the story in third person, so that you're actually hearing your own story and you're beginning to expand your articulation of the story so it's not stuck in one point of view. And if it is really a difficult story, because you've allowed it to be fully told, I very often have somebody really reflect on what the medicine in that story is for their future, for their future life, how what they've learned from that story can change their life in the present. What was beautiful? What did they learn through suffering or joy? Other things as well. I have hidden doors in this story where you travel so that you can find sort of mythic underpinning, like having a waking dream in the middle of your story. And it's all of this kind of deep imaginative work with your memory that suddenly brings up from the unconscious, and it's always happened, some kind of precious jewel from that story that is the redemption or another way of seeing it, or a gift that came from it that makes you feel like you, even if it was a difficult story, that you had an immense treasure, you had an immense activity, an immense experience that can feed your life, even if it's to let you help others in your life, to be kind to others because you understand the effect of kindness. Of course, that's what happened with my son Ishmael, to take the story of his journey as a child soldier and realize that by framing that story in a particular way, you can allow people to experience it, but to recognize that you do not have to define yourself by abuse or misery or hopelessness, that you can actually not just falsely or trying to fix up by changing your story, but from deep within the experience itself, you can reframe that story so you see it as something of value. And it is
Laura.
Yeah?
I really enjoyed the part where you were talking about you started to tell a story that you weren't thoroughly familiar with. I thought, it's interesting that you're making yourself vulnerable over there before, a group of people. But the question that I have is that you've traveled so much and offered programs here and there. What type of a group would be, did you find that it was most, receptive to this notion of sharing their stories and entering into a deeper form of hearing? And
Well, first of all, I'm always vulnerable. And I have never in my life had a memorized performance that wasn't completely receptive and related to the particular audience I was with. So I don't have like a package of tools and then I do these things and expect certain results at all. So I find a way of being with whoever I'm with. And so I think everyone loves to go deep into their story. Maybe not everybody likes to share their story. They may be shy culturally or because of things in their lives, but there is an indirect way in which I'm working that allows people to tell stories as opposed to sort of confessionals or bearing their soul kind of thing. There's a structure to it so that there is a certain distance, an and dignity, and they can still feel the depth of it. I love what you said at the beginning, and I wanted to say that more and more I'm really loving going somewhere and not knowing the story, or just starting a story and say, do you know this, or what do you think happened? And having a conversation in which people can express themselves and offer something back into the story, and then sometimes at the end I tell my version of the story just to bring things to a closure, or sometimes I just repeat, like I did working with gypsy women in Romania, I'll repeat the five different versions that came up and say, this is interesting, and here's the one I read in the beginning, but I loved all these that you came up with. Is that a helpful answer?
Yes, thank you.
Who is this?
Who were you?
Yeah.
Speaker?
Andy Frankel.
Oh, Andy, hi.
Laura, how do you move the empowering of the mothers into how they connect to their children?
Well, one thing is I have a tremendous sense of trust that if you really open up the doors of perception and give people the template of story, then it's an experience. So then they repeat it for their own children. And with mentors who went back and are still going back. In fact, I heard from the translator today. They will talk about the experience. What happened when you were with Laura? What happened with your children? And let people talk themselves about their experience and why it made a difference. I didn't have in Haiti and in Romania and in Nepal. One of the things that I did was work with the translators. And in Romania, actually, I had a package of 48 stories that I had Xeroxed and translated into Romanian that went to the mothers, and they had it with them so that they could feel confident that they had stories, because they didn't have a lot of connection to the storytelling in their own culture. In Haiti, a lot of the women did have stories, but I, with IMC in the last few days with Fafeda and actually one of the psychiatrists, we translated and made packets of stories, including the stories that the mentors had created about their own childhoods, so that it would inspire the mothers to tell stories from their own childhood. And the training that I gave the mentors was that they would repeat a series of the activities that I did with the mothers, so that the mothers were creating stories that then they could tell to their children. But I think once you see, I mean, it was most dramatic in the orphanages, where there would be something like four staff and 80 children. Mostly just kept in cribs that looked like cages because nobody could tend to them. And what was most dramatic was that the staff and my mentors saw that a single person telling a story and engaging the children could give a large group of children an experience of being, of participating, of feeling that they were being spoken to, and of actively waking up and being alive and engaged imaginatively and physically, rhythmically, in an event that they could do that for an hour or two every day with a large group of children, even though they were a small staff. The staff was just stymied with not knowing how to function at all, overwhelmed, and they were amazed at everyone joining in and participating.
This is in Romania?
No, this is in Haiti.
Oh, this is in Haiti.
This is in Haiti. In fact, I'm trying to decide what I want to do now that my major program with Mercy Corps is over, the major training. And I've been thinking about this aspect of working in the orphanages and the kind of apathy and sort of blankness in a lot of those children's lives, and how if I could train people to go in, tell stories, and also then get the children to draw. One day I went into one orphanage and got the children to create a group story. It took about 45 minutes. And it was wonderful to see them. Anything they said, I accepted and put in the story, where suddenly they could make something, that they could say something, and it was important and part of something, just brought them alive. Anything they said, I would say, oh, yes, and then that happened. And a little child would say something else, and I would say, well, what happened to the bird? And they would say something preposterous, and I would say, yes, that's what happened to the bird. And then you just see these little lights come on, and their hilarity of knowing it didn't make sense, but that was okay, because it was the willingness to be part of something, to be valued. And the secret for me and there is that when you wake up the power of the imagination, you can't give a child what they didn't have. It's lost. But within everyone is this capacity for renewal and for imagination. So if that door is open, then they can find some sense of inner home and inner empowerment that makes them at least feel that they're not lacking completely. And they can nourish that can be flowered and grow. And there are all those wonderful stories of orphans or in fairy tales who become the great heroes and heroines of the stories. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, oh my God, that's like me. I can be the hero or heroine. I'm really special.
So, Laura, you didn't have a feeling of hesitation of bringing up to those children the fact that a parent was dead or gone or absent. Like you didn't.
Well, I didn't point out their parents being dead or absent. So it's within the context of the story. And
so they can relate to it without. Yeah, I see.
And it's how you tell a story. It's who's telling a story and how it's being told. I mean, the same story could be told in a way that draws someone into a feeling of immense sorrow or fixation on a very, very painful memory. But if the storytellers themselves has some access or awareness of themselves as neutral in a way, you can take people in and out of situations, and it is a story. So that there is some distance. It's like playing a role. But that's where I think the meditation has been so important in my life, because I've had to practice over and over again daily this quality of becoming familiar with some spacious, unconditional aspect of mind. And the storyteller can draw on that, as opposed to referring someone into their misery. You can actually, it's indirect enough. And you're also watching. I mean, I'm never lost in my story, even if I'm deeply engaged in it. My job is to be there for my listeners. So if I see that I'm about to say something and I can already sense that the death of that horse will be devastating, I might say, and then the horse was so old that he looked up at the prince, and the prince understood that the horse was ready to die. So the prince climbed off the horse's back, and very slowly the horse lay down. And the prince caressed him, and he died. And then the wolf ate the horse. But, I mean, because I could see that it was, that it would be so devastating. But I didn't change the story. I just allowed it to be, death to be natural, and for them to live through it in a different way. You follow what I'm saying?
Yeah. No, that's, it sounds so tricky because it, you know, it's, but if you're attuned to the audience, I imagine, then it's, you know, you really, it's a great skill you have. Because
I think
it's,
if
does that come up?
Trained to be attuned to the audience, then we shouldn't be telling stories in this kind of context.
Right, right.
Okay.
Maybe any context.
does that come up also in Haiti, of when they're sharing the stories of the fear of the day of the earthquake?
Well, that was...
how did you work
really
with that?
I invented a whole process
uh-huh.
of how to talk about fear by making fear a character and allowing them to talk to their fear,
mm-hmm.
To give them enough distance that sort of psychologically they became powerful over their fear. So their fear did not have to be the only show in town. And then when they talked about it, I mean, they talked about how liberating that was.
Did you incorporate that into a story or more
I think it was more like a therapeutic way of... No, it was more like a living story.
Mm-hmm.
It was a process.
Mm-hmm.
It took over an hour, this process.
Mm.
But... you know, one of the beauties of the storyteller being extremely present and not lost in either their own emotion or their own interpretation of a story is that you're there, you know, saying there was once a boy who was terrified of snakes. And you're just saying it. And then the boy can speak and he can say, I'm so terrified. But then the storyteller comes back, and the storyteller might say, and the boy was really scared. So that really the only place that a story is happening is not in the story, but in the imaginative landscape that's drawn out of the listener. So the whole story is occurring inside the listener. So what you're doing is really practicing giving people the capacity to experience fear and then to move out of the fear and see it and then to experience it, move out of it, then to experience maybe cheerfulness, then to come out of it, then to experience sorrow and to come out of it. So it's making the mind more pliable rather than just stuck in one emotional crisis. So it's giving, it's like practicing, rehearsing the capacity to experience the fear but not be thoroughly consumed by it. It's usually the biggest fear we have is that the fear itself will ride on us like a huge beast and we won't be able to get out from under it. So this, if you begin to learn the way in which the engagement functions and its benefits, not just the content of the story, but the very way in which reciprocity works and visualization works in the mind, then you can begin to help people to have this experience of being able to move with dignity in and out of emotional states through the indirect journey of the story, so that then in their lives they may remember not to be consumed or overwhelmed by it, but suddenly some intelligence or some awareness can come in and say, wow, I'm feeling afraid.
We've just arrived at 10 o'clock. I don't know if there are a few more questions that we can handle in the next couple of minutes. If there are any.
Well, I just want to say thank you, Laura. I'm going to sign off, but this is Alicia, and it was wonderful to hear you and very inspiring, and the work sounds really amazing, just truly a beautiful way to use a wonderful art form to help people.
Well, I'm really trying to write as much of it as I can so I can share it and so we can all dialogue about it, because I'm sure that everyone has many, many aspects of this that we've each been experiencing, and I think that collaboratively sharing these experiences, we can begin to be more and more intelligent about what we're doing and bring tremendous benefit by really opening the mind to more joy and compassion.
The world needs it.
Laura, before you go, could you give an example again of this moving in and out of these different difficult emotions?
Yes, I can.
Laura,
there's a very classic
story.
Hello?
Hello? Somebody just signed off.
Somebody just signed off.
Yes.
There's
good
a very
all.
Classic story I tell of the woodcutter and the snake. And it's a Korean story. I've retold it. It's actually, I posted a version of it on YouTube recently from 1986. But in this story, a woodcutter confronts a terrifying woman. So as a storyteller, I say, and the woodcutter opened the door. And it's just me saying that. It's not... And he saw a woman, I describe her. And she's quite terrifying. And then she said to him, I have waited for you for 25 years. And a chill ran down the woodcutter's back.
And the what?
So it's...
chill goes down his back.
Okay.
There is a... there's a definite distance and difference between the storyteller who is narrating and then the moments when I become something.
Mm-hmm.
So that allows a tremendous clarity in the listener, I think. So the listener then can feel the fear, and you can also feel the aggression and the cunning and the dark, shadowy qualities of the witch who turns into a snake and attempts to annihilate him. So that, but it's all happening within one person. So what you are practicing, in a sense, is the neutral ground or the unbiased ground. And then you become both the terrified woodcutter, and it draws up from your own psyche this possibility, and then you also become the shadow transformative, you know, terrifying aspect. And you also become the completely compassionate birds. You become the house. You become the bowl of food. You become the silence, the walls, the door, each of us. So it is that what's happening inside of us is where the storytelling is really profound. So that if the storyteller gets lost in thing, and then the woodcutter was really afraid, and he said, I'm so afraid, and she said, I'm going to kill you. There is no place of trust or stability.
Mm-hmm.
So we can practice. And the boy said, I'm terrified. And the demon said, you should be. And the little dog that was over the side said, no, it's that movement back and forth that allows for flexibility in one state of mind, as opposed, so you're working from a very internal level on that. I'm not a therapist, so I'm working with mind in a different way. I'm not solving problems. I'm giving
you
your capacities.
Great, thank you.
Wow.
That helps.
Yep.
I wanted to end by just telling you one thing, amazing thing. The last moment of the last trip in Haiti, I was very, very busy. I was helping a women's group and girls, and the weather was terrible, and it was 110 degrees, and then there were monsoon rains, and people's tents were collapsing, and it was filthy, and I was completely exhausted and speeding around. is completely everything, the opposite of everything I'm saying here. And just completely occupied by this state of mind. And all of a sudden, a little boy who had been one of the 80 children that I had been telling stories to months before, he saw me and he came running over and, he just looked at me and this little hand just grabbed my hand. And he said to me, "Tapingi." It was the name of a story that I had told. And he gave back to me my own sanity.
Beautiful.
So thank you all so much, and thank you, Mike.
Thank you, Laura.
Thank you
for a wonderful gift. And it will be, in the next few days, posted on the website.
And if you can get the book, Our Secret Territory talks a lot about some of these things, and I'm just finishing a book now called Magicians of Grass, which is descriptions of this work. It'll take me maybe another year to edit. But.
Wow. We're all so fortunate that you're such a giving person, Laura. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Laura.
Thank you, Laura.
Thank you,
Laura.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.